With the exception of a couple of pretty dismal semesters before I went in the military, we won't talk about that. I did almost all of my college work after the military. So I was not, you know, a peachy-faced kid right out of high school. I'm sorry, you guys. I'm not meaning an insult. So by the time I went to college, I was married and had a child. I had traveled the world and fought a war. I had a lot of experience. I had a lot of maturity by that point. And so, as a part of my major, I signed up for a public speaking course. And after all I'd been through, I thought, this piece of cake. Not so. My public speaking class had about 15 people in it, and we were given our first assignment. It was to be just a 3-minute speech, and I was to give that speech in front of my class of about 15 people and my instructor. And I'm just sharing that with you to say, the night before I was to give that speech, I was so nervous that I vomited. Fast forward 3 years. By now, I'm graduated from college. 3 years more of maturity, 3 more years of experience. Educated man, ready for the world. Recruited by one of what at that time was one of the Fortune 50 corporations in the United States. And this corporation then, for its recruits, as they brought us into their corporation, required that we take a public speaking course. Well, I'd already done this. You know, I'm an old hand at this. And so the night before my public speaking, and this was to be a 15-minute speech, I was giving this in front of the other 7 or 8 guys that were recruited with me, in front of our instructor. His name was Tom Hendricks. I still remember this. And in front of the founder and CEO of this corporation, little short guy with big ears, Ross Perot was his name. The night before I gave that 15-minute speech, I was so nervous I vomited. Now, let me ask you, does this seem like the kind of man God would call into the preaching ministry? If I were God, I wouldn't even look at that guy. And I wish I could say it got better. Over the next 7 years, I was in the banking leg of EDS. That was the name of the company. I made presentations before bank boards and this, so on and so forth. I was always so nervous I could barely stand it. And I'm sure the people could always tell how nervous I was. And I'm just sharing all this with you to say, I know what it's like to be nervous about speaking to people. I really, really do. I mean, you look at me now, and I'm pretty comfortable. Look, I've done this 10 trillion times now, and I'm an old man. What am I having to be afraid of? Well, if you say you're nervous about presenting the gospel to people, I get it. I get it. And sometimes it's more nerve-wracking to make a presentation before one individual than it is before a group of people. So I do understand what it is you're saying and what it is you're going through. It paralyzes you, doesn't it? Well, this morning we're going to be looking at Acts chapter 8, beginning in verse 4, just a few verses, and talk about our presentation, presenting the gospel. I hope this is going to be liberating for you. I hope this is going to set you free. God wants our presentation of the gospel to be informal and comfortable. not nerve-shattering, not frightening. That's not his plan. His plan is not that we step out of our skin. His plan is not that we do those kinds of things that are totally outside of our tool house. In our study, for those of you who've been with us every Sunday, Stephen has been stoned to death. His death has served two important purposes. One purpose it served is it has implanted in the mind and in the heart and in the soul of a young man named Saul. It's planted in his soul what it means to be a Christ follower. God's going to use that later to accomplish great things. But the other important purpose this has served, the stoning of Stephen, it has taken the other Greek-speaking Jews who've given their lives to Christ, it has sent those people scattered to the four winds. I mean, you know, if they're going to stone Stephen, they'll certainly stone us, and they take off. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. So they are gone. Now, follow along with me here in Acts chapter 8, beginning in verse 4. To those who were scattered, went on their way proclaiming the message of good news. Philip went down to a city in Samaria, and by the way, in biblical writing, any direction you go from Jerusalem is down. Jerusalem is on a hill. So any direction a person goes from Jerusalem is considered down. Actually, they went north. Philip went north. Philip went down, I'm pointing south. Philip went down to a city in Samaria and preached the Messiah to them. The crowds paid attention with one mind to what Philip said as they heard and saw the signs he was performing. For unclean spirits, crying out with a loud voice, came out of many who were possessed, and many who were paralyzed and lame were healed. Look at verse 8. So there was great joy in that city. And we're going to stop there. What do we learn in this passage about how the Lord wants us to present the gospel? Now, I've already said this can be liberating to many of us. Here's where I want to begin. What we're looking at here is a casual presentation. We're looking at a casual presentation of the gospel. So we see here that these 5,000 or more Greek-speaking Jews who've given their lives to Christ, they're being scattered in all directions. Primarily, we're told, throughout Judea and Samaria. It says that there in verse 2. Not a lot of method to their exit. They're not following a plan. They're not following a strategy. We shouldn't labor over that untruth. Since Jerusalem was their hometown, we should not be under the impression they were going back anywhere. That's not the case. Or they're not going to predetermined locations. That's not the case either. They were refugees. They were running from persecution. They weren't running to anything. These are people on the run. Verse 4 in the Holman Christian Bible that I'm reading from this morning says, on their way, the capitalization is mine, on their way they proclaimed the message of good news. So let's establish this. On their way through life, Christ followers talk about Christ. That means us too. On our way through life, we talk about Jesus. And then listen to the same verse from the New International Version. Many of you might be carrying that translation. They preached the word wherever they went from there. So here's another image we have of these people. Wherever they go, Christ followers talk about Christ. On their way, wherever they go. Not planned to talk about Christ. Not a strategy to talk about Christ. We're looking here at a casual dialogue in Philip of talking about Christ as he goes, as they go, no matter where it is they're going. Global missions expert Paul Borthwick shared this story. I want to just read it to you. I stopped into a McDonald's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and noticed Peter working the counter. I recognized him from our young adult ministry at church, and I knew he had just graduated from Harvard University with a master's degree. I greeted him and managed to get him to break free for a coffee together. "What are you doing here?" I asked, knowing that Harvard master's degree students don't usually aspire to work the counter at McDonald's. "Well," he explained, "I graduated in May, but I went 4 months without finding a job. So I said to myself, I need some income to pay bills. So this is where I've ended up, at least for now." "I'm so sorry to hear that. It must be hard," I replied. But Peter cut me off. "No, don't be sorry. God has me here. This place is giving me awesome opportunities to share my faith. I'm on a shift that includes a Buddhist guy from Sri Lanka, a Muslim fellow from Lebanon, a Hindu lady from India, and a fellow Christian from El Salvador. It's awesome. I get to be a global missionary to my coworkers while asking, would you like fries with that?" You know, so here's a young man who found himself in a setting he never planned to travel. You know, here, he's got a master's degree from Harvard University. He had plans to go into business, perhaps, or to go into consulting work, or whatever it was he got his graduate degree in. That's where he planned to be. But he finds himself instead working the counter at McDonald's. He was not a trained theologian. His master's degree was not in theology. He was not a trained public speaker. He was not a pastor / preacher / missionary. He's simply a guy who belongs to the Lord and recognizing that God is in control of his life and has put him here in a McDonald's and has presented him by divine appointment with some people who need to hear about Jesus. That's his situation. Does that sound familiar? He was simply on his way through life. Now, that's the image we have of these people here in our passage. They were on their way to somewhere else. And wherever they found themselves along the way, they just paused and talked to folks about Christ. They weren't trained. This is not something, this is not part of their gift set. They were not comfortable with this initially. Just casually along the way, they became accustomed to, I'm sure it wasn't easy for them to start with, they became accustomed to talking to folks around them about Jesus, about his story. They just shared the story of Jesus as they knew it up to that point, as they had experienced it, just sharing the story of Jesus. Now, here's what I'm saying. Why do you suppose God has given us this insight, this look at Philip and these believers running from persecution? Why would he include this? I'm telling you, it's just so we understand the presentation of the gospel for all of us except the pros is casual. It's casual. Here's another thing I want us to look at. I'll call this a curious presentation. Let me show you what I mean. In verse 5, we see that one of the Greek-speaking Jewish Christians who has been run out of Jerusalem was this man named Philip. Philip was the second man named as a deacon elected by the congregation, mentioned back in chapter 6, verse 5, right after Stephen. So Philip has fled from Jerusalem, north of the city to the region of Samaria, we're told here. You remember what Jesus said in his first, or his last, really, conversation with the disciples back in chapter 1, verse 8? He said, talking to his followers, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea," and where else? Samaria. So let's not labor on the false understanding that Philip and many of these folks have wound up in Samaria by accident. Kind of a rough road for them, give it that. But they're not there by accident at all. Here we have the Lord's plan continuing to unfold in the midst of what appears to be chaos. The city in Samaria to which Philip has fled is probably the ancient city of Shechem. We're not told, but that's probably where he is. Now, the reason all this is noteworthy is because up to this point, the story of Jesus has only been explained to Jews. Samaritans were not Jews. This is kind of a breach in protocol. It's a breach in protocol to share the story of Jesus and salvation with someone other than Jews. Have you ever noticed that God is not much on religious protocol? We kind of get hung up on that, don't we? Jesus never got hung up on all the religious protocol. Let's talk a little bit about Samaria. 722 years before Christ was born, the northern kingdom of Israel was defeated by the Assyrians, and all the upper class, all the politicians, all the wealthy, all the movers and shakers were taken as prisoners back to Assyria. And what they left behind were the common folks, the blue-collar workers, the everyday people, you know, the merchants. That's who's been left behind there in the northern kingdom. So what's happened is these everyday folks have intermingled, totally intermingled with non-Jews of every flavor, every shade, every background. Totally diluted the Jewish bloodline. But even though the bloodline was lost, they still considered themselves to be the people of God. They still had their own version of Scripture. They built their own temple because they weren't in Jerusalem. They kept some of the original Jewish traditions, and they looked for their own version of the Messiah. So these folks were not looking for any religious counsel from anybody from Jerusalem. They weren't looking for any help, any religious help from any Jew. They sure weren't looking for any help from a Greek-speaking Hellenistic Jew. They don't want to hear anything from Philip. "We don't care what you have to say about anything religious." That's like us, right? People don't want to hear what we have to say about Jesus. They have their own version going on. They have their own version of Christianity going on. Why would they listen to us? Why would they listen to me? Why would they listen to you? That's what we're facing here. Kind of like today. If anyone is not a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jewish or an atheist, if people don't affiliate with any of those groups, by default, everybody considers themselves to be a Christian. Right? You know, are you a Christian? Yeah. I'm not Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim or atheist. Yeah, I must be a Christian. If these people were going to listen to Philip, he needed to present them with something interesting to pique their curiosity. That's why in verse 6, we read this, "The crowds paid attention with one mind to what Philip said as they heard and saw the signs he was performing." And then after that, we see him casting out demons and healing the sick. If the lost people and the by-name-only Christians, you hear me say that a lot. Let me stop. I call them B&Os. A B&O Christian is a Christian by name only. So excuse me if I use that term. if any non-Christ followers or any who were Christ followers by name only, we've got a lot of those folks sitting right here. If any of those people were going to listen to Peter, they needed to see some evidence. Same thing today. We need to present them with something to pique their curiosity. Let me just tell you this. Let me just confess this, just so you won't be misled by anything I have to say to you. I can't do any of the stuff Philip was doing. I can't cast out demons. I don't guess. I've never tried. I guess if someone were to come to me and say, I'm demon-possessed, Pastor, can you cast out this demon? I would call the staff down to my office, and we would lay on hands and attempt to cast the demon out, but I've never done that. I can't lay my hands on somebody and declare them healed. I can't do that. I can't raise somebody from the dead. In fact, if I were to stand over a corpse and say, live again, if that corpse were to stand up, boom, boy, I'd be knocking a hole in the back door. I'd be getting out of there. I'm just saying to you, I can't do any of the things that Philip did to prove his story valid. And what can we do to pique their curiosity? Well, I'm going to tell you this. We can show them the difference of our transformed lives. That's what we can do. I'm a Christ follower. Let me live a transformed life before you. That'll blow their minds. When Pastor D.A. Carson was in college, he witnessed the following dialogue between a fellow college student and a strong Christ follower named Dave. That's all he tells us about these two students. Let me just read this. The student began by saying this. I came from a family that doesn't believe in a literal resurrection and all that stuff. That's a bit much for us. But we're a fine family, a good church-going family. We love each other, care for each other. We do good in the community. We're a stable family, so what have you got that we don't have? Dave, strong Christ follower, answered, watch me. Move in with me. I have an extra bed. Just follow me around. See how I behave. See what's important to me. See what I do with my time. See how I talk. You watch me, and at the end of 3 months, you tell me there's no difference. Man, that's powerful. Pastor Carson said the other student did not take Dave up on his offer. He didn't move in with him, but the other student watched Dave's life, and in time, he agreed, Dave has something I don't have. Dave has something my family doesn't have. Dave has a transformed life. I want what he has. And that student gave his life to Christ and became a missionary, became a medical missionary. Dave didn't heal the sick, he didn't cast out demons, he didn't raise the dead. He just lived an impossibly victorious life in front of this other student. Unless you can heal the sick, unless you can cast out demons, unless you can raise the dead, I just want to suggest to you, if you're going to be able to talk to anybody about Christ, you better have something they don't have. You better have a life they don't have. You better have a joy they don't have. You better have a victory they don't have. You better have a marriage they don't have. You better have a strength in your soul and your gut that they don't have. Because if you have that, they'll listen to you. They'll listen to you. Curiosity. Curiosity will cause them to listen. Okay, we're looking at presentation, casual, curious presentation. One last thing I want to dwell on here, and that is Philip's was a contagious presentation. Something about Philip's presentation of Jesus was contagious. They're among these people who didn't care for him because he was a Jew. Somehow it worked. This presentation worked. The Holy Spirit anointed Philip's presentation of the gospel, amateur as it might have been. Verse 8 says, "So there was great joy in that city." Bam! Bam! There it goes. They watched him. They listened to him. Bam! They bought into what he was saying, and they had joy in their life. The story of Christ in a transformed life brings joy. Again, he wasn't a theologian. Wasn't a preacher. There were no pastors yet. He was not an experienced speaker. He was just like us. Just like us. That's why God includes it in this book of Acts. And you know what? I need to back up a little bit. I need to back up off this. I said he's just like us. I have 2 degrees in theology from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary that I worked hard to get. And I've been doing this work for almost 35 years. I've preached 10,000 sermons, I guess. I've never counted them. It doesn't bother me to share Christ with anybody. I don't care how big the group is. I don't care how important they are. I don't care. So let me just back myself out of this. Philip was not like me at all. Philip's like you. He's like you. No formal training. Not a speaker. Not the eloquent preacher that his predecessor Stephen was. My goodness, Stephen preached for a whole chapter. Philip's not like that. Philip's not like that. Philip just goes and casual, creates some curiosity in their lives, has a contagious life and a contagious word. And I'm telling you what, joy in the city that night. Joy in the city that night. You know, there are scientific measurements for how well heavenly bodies reflect the light of the sun. For example, the planet Venus reflects 65% of all the light that hits it. All the light from the sun that hits the surface of Venus, it reflects. Bright planet, 65%. And then there's this little wannabe planet. Remember when Pluto used to be a planet? They've demoted Pluto. Pluto is no longer a planet, but my conviction is Pluto still wants to be a planet. It's way out there on the outer extremities of the solar system. Pluto, depending on where it is in its rotation, reflects between 49% and 66% of all the light that hits it. Way to go, Pluto. Our moon, our little old moon, only reflects 7% of the sunlight that hits the moon. I'm a country boy. You ever been out on a night when there's a full moon in the country? I mean, that 7% of light that's reflected off the moon is enough. It's enough to see everything. So even though just reflecting 7%, oh my goodness, what a great impact that has. Philippians chapter 2, verse 15 says, "Be blameless and pure, children of God who are faultless in a crooked and perverted generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world." Like stars. But you know, that's not even really accurate, because stars put off their own light. We have no light. We have no light like stars. All we can do is reflect the light. All we can do is reflect Jesus. It'd be great if we could reflect like Venus, but at least we ought to reflect like the moon. We ought to be able to reflect Jesus. We ought to be contagious. You agree with that? Philip apparently had this passion. He had an enthusiasm. He had, a strength of conviction. So that as he told the story of Jesus, as it impacted him at that point, people bought into it, and it brought joy to the city. Like Philip, we need to be contagious. I want to share this with you. Henrietta Mears died in 1963. Dynamic educator, dynamic author, wrote the best-selling book, What the Bible is All About. Major impact on Billy Graham. Major impact on Bill Bright, the founder of Crusaders for Christ. This amazing Bible teacher in her book wrote this. Are you proving that the Christian life is a joyful and happy thing? Check yourself carefully on this. Make the Christian life contagious. Man. You don't have to take all those courses I took. I took so many courses. You don't have to take any of those. None of them. You don't have to memorize anything. But Jesus would appreciate it as we're going through life, wherever it is we go, in a very comfortable and casual way, we just talk about Him, for crying out loud. We just tell whoever it is we're around about the story of Jesus as it has impacted our lives. We just appeal to their curiosity by living this victorious life in front of them, and we become contagious like our long ago ancestors. What do you think? Can we do this? Can we do this? There's an old country term that describes sitting, existing, taking up time and space, and doing nothing. It's called being a stump on a log. I'm either going to be contagious for Jesus or I'm going to be a stump on a log. And I want to tell you something. Christianity didn't cover the whole earth with by name only Christians who are nothing more than stumps on a log. Let's get this. Let's set Pflugerville on fire for Christ. Let's set Austin and Travis County on fire for Christ Jesus by just being followers of Christ who have something to say. Can we do that? Pray with me.